That's a gay ass podcast.
What? That's a gay ass podcast.
A what?
A really, really, really gay podcast that we call That's a Gay Ass Podcast.
That's a gay ass name for a gay ass podcast.
Welcome back to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, the podcast that asks, whose fault is it that you're gay? It's me, Eric Williams, and what a gift, because today, Michael Urie is on That's a Gay Ass Podcast. It feels like I've been blessed by the gay ass universe, because in the same month, I talked to Kathy Griffin, our first straight guest, Gianmarco Cerezi. We now get the king of stage and screen, Michael Urie. In fact, he just received an Emmy nomination for Shrinking with Harrison Ford. And we do talk about the viral photo that I posted with Bowen Yang, Michael Urie, and Coleman Domingo cheering on Jeffrey Hiller's win. It's a very gay sesh, lots of character actress conversation, and just the dream that is Michael Urie. Enjoy. Michael goddamn Urie, it's a big day to celebrate you. How is your gay ass day going? You're in a gorgeous hotel. Tell me how you are.
I'm here in the gorgeous Hotel Edison in the heart of Times Square, doing some stuff today. Tonight I'm hosting the Tectonic Theater Company Gala.
Shout out.
Yay, Tectonic Theater Company. They do really amazing work. I worked with their artistic director, Moises Kaufman, on the Very Gay Torch song, and have been a friend of the company ever since. And so tonight, and I'm wearing a lot of fun costumes tonight. We're also doing some publicity later for Richard II down at the Drama Bookshop and over at the West Bank Cafe. So it's going to be, and I'm with you now, so it couldn't get much gayer.
And we celebrate that. Well, I have to tell you, Michael, that the last time I saw you was in Once Upon a Mattress in Los Angeles. And I got to say a quick hello to you after. That show is one of the first musicals that told me I was gay. When I was in sixth grade, my older brother played in the orchestra at his high school production. Wow. And Sutton Foster has always been my number one Broadway diva. So to see you do Once Upon a Mattress with her, and you were, I mean, when I butter biscuits here, I do it very genuinely. You were so divine. And I just have so much celebrating to do with you on this gay ass podcast. But since I am a gay journalist, you've said in an interview, Michael Urie, that as you prep for Richard II, that you and Richard are both lousy with money. Michael, say more. What are you spending it on?
Well, I will spend so much money on like a dinner or a bottle of scotch, or you know, I won't like spend money on a car. I don't own a car. I won't buy a car. I won't buy nice clothes for myself. But I will like drop major money. I'll be like, yeah, I think we should get the caviar. And my partner is very good with money. And so he's always like, don't do that. To the point where if we're buying something together, he will push back so much that we will end up probably not buying it at all.
Which was his goal.
Which was his goal. Like today, for example, he's in Richard II as well. And we move into the theater tomorrow. And I'm playing Richard II, so I'm the fucking star. He's also in it and brilliant, but I'm going to need to nap. And so I was like, babe, we need to buy a mat. He and I are sharing a dressing room. I'm like, we need to buy a mat, a fold-up mat for our dressing room. And we started, he's going to be mad I'm telling the story, but we started looking for one online. And I was like, fine, let's find one that we both like, and we'll get it to the dressing room just in time so that on the first day of tech, which is a 12-hour day, in my very limited free time, I can take a nap. And he fought me on it, on which one we would buy, to the point where we didn't buy one. And it's tomorrow. And as I was leaving, like we had to leave or something. It was like, we were looking, this one, no, don't get that one. That was too expensive. Don't get that one. And then today I was leaving the house for this long day of stuff. And I was like, hey babe, I'm leaving. Just so you know, we didn't buy a mat. And we start rehearsal tomorrow. So if you could just do me a huge favor and make that happen for me. And my voice got higher and higher.
Yep. Whistle tone. If it makes you feel better, my husband and I also do have financial discussions where he loves to purchase. And actually, so you're the Mike. So he's the Michael Urey, I guess.
But, yeah.
But I think when I make my money, I think I will turn into the Michael Urey that spends it on food and experiences, because yes. I don't really care about material goods. I do care about getting a $25 smoothie because I added spirulina.
And well, spirulina makes it better because spirulina is good because it's expensive.
Thank you. And that's why we spend money on expensive smoothies. But I think it's also like Michael Urey himself knows his worth, and he knows that he deserves to rest during tech. And he's also a busy Betty. I mean, the fact that you have had such a gorgeous gay life, even recently with Oh Mary on Broadway. Can we talk about the gay experience of Donna McKechnie coming to see you and then you getting a photo with her backstage? Can you tell me, Michael, were you a chorus line gay? What was the cast recording that you were spinning as a youngin versus a nowin?
Well, certainly a chorus line was in the rotation, OBC of a chorus line. I was a real big fan of, there was a bunch of shows that came through my, I'm from Dallas, and all the shows that would come through became my go-to. So, there was a chorus line that came through. I remember that being very special. And we would always sit way up high. We would sit like at the Dallas Fair Park Music Hall, which is like the biggest place in the world. And we would sit way, way in the back. And, you know, so a chorus line was like, I think I see them. But it was still beautiful and amazing. Damn Yankees came through with Jerry Lewis. How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying came through with Ralph Macchio. Fabulous.
And then you did on Broadway.
Carousel. And then I did, yes, that was one that I saw that show and I said, I got to do that. Roger Bart was playing Bud Frump in that production. And I was like, that's my part. I'm playing that part. I'm chasing that part to the ends of the earth. And that's how I ended up in it, because I chased it. And then Carousel came through. This amazing production of Carousel from the 90s that was Audra McDonald's big break as not the main woman, but the friend.
Sure,
Nelly.
Sure. Yeah, Nelly.
Nelly, is that? That production came through Dallas, and it was absolutely stunning. The most beautiful thing I've ever seen. It was this, and it has this amazing huge prologue, this piece of music that goes on for like 10 minutes and is usually dancing or whatever. And this version, there were all of these horses, these like carousel horses that moved independently of each other somehow. And they were like all over the stage. And it was like, oh my God, there's another carousel horse over there. There's another carousel horse over there. And the main guy, Billy Bigelow, is a carnival barker. And at a certain point, he like jumped on a thing and he was like, everyone come out and ride the carousel. And somehow they all ended up in a circle, moving in a circle.
And they toured that. Are you one of those girls that's like
I missed when they had big sets on Broadway? It's now LED screens and projections.
Are you one of those girls that
Oh yeah. Give me a ship. Give me a chandelier. Give me a mansion flying in from the sky. I love that stuff. I do. You know, I mean, it is amazing what they could do with projections. And I've seen so many beautiful things. But I want them to bring in a big boat. I want them to bring in a big house.
When I saw Oh Mary, I was actually gagged by, because I think our expectations now are so much lower in terms of set. So when I saw, I was like, okay, I'm seeing a play that Cole has written that I know is going to be an amazing play, but I haven't heard much about like things besides the writing of the play, the performances, but then to see like the actual sets and the way that they employ lighting and such, like, I don't know, it feels like Sam Pinkleton has geniusly put a group of people together that just like leans into the theatricality of it all. I think it's so amazing that you are a part of the legacy of all of these people who have done that show. The fact that Jane Krakowski is now doing it, that you got to do it with Camille Nanjiani. Is there like an Oh Mary cast orgy that the press has not covered?
Where we all get together and have sex?
Yeah.
Yeah, there is.
I thought so.
There is a big old orgy. And it's in my dressing room. Well, it was Ms. Al Cheyenne's dressing room, but it was my dressing room.
And you did buy a bed for that dressing room.
And I had to leave it because it was contaminated.
Covered with seed. Well, listen, Michael Urie, it is not a gay ass podcast if I do not ask you the gay ass podcast question, which is whose fault is it that you're gay? Who do we blame, babe?
Bernadette. We blame Bernadette Peters because when she came into my life, it was as I was learning about, you know, This period where I was like going to the Fair Park Music Hall and I was seeing musicals and I started to be in musicals and I had friends who were like, but do you even know this musical? Do you even know Sondheim? Do you even know this? Do you even know this? And of course, Into the Woods is the most perfect gateway musical for any teenager because it teaches you about everything.
Yeah.
And here was this woman, Bernadette Peters, who was like my little hormonal gay ass, was like, I don't know what to feel. I want her to make love to me. I want to be her. I want her before me in this dress, and then I want to put this dress on.
Oh, yeah.
I want to take it off of her, see what's there, and then I want to put it on me, and then vice versa. She'll take, so it was like, it was a whole like, and then I realized, oh, it's definitely that I am her. She is me. She's my mother. She created me.
A second, though, you saw Bernadette's tits and you were like, do I want to be enveloped by them or have them as a chest plate?
It was, yes, exactly. It was like, mama or mama.
You were going to do like, you were going to do sucky sucky one way or the other. It was just like, you're either taking the lactation as child or you are sort of wondering if it's like,
yes,
a sexual situation. Yes. Well, I hate to like bring it sex into it, but no, I don't actually love to. Let's reclaim. I'm going to reclaim because the first time I had like a, speaking of mattresses, a mattress put on the floor of my freshman dorm room at NYU, my first like boy roll around makeout was while the Bernadette Peters Into the Woods VHS was playing.
Oh my God. Okay. So here's how we're connected, you and me. When Ryan and I courted, mm-hmm, when we were first dating, I was subletting an apartment from legendary Carol Kane.
This is lore.
I know. And her furniture, I hope it's okay that I tell this. She would probably be honored that she was very proud of the furniture. It was lovely, beautiful, mint green living room set. Diane Keaton's old furniture. Right? Both of us touching our pearls. Listener.
I'm breathing that in. Holy.
Really cute furniture. Carol had this really cute apartment on Central Park West, and I was subletting it. Right when Ugly Betty was in New York. I was in LA, and then it moved to New York. And so I didn't have a place, so I sublet her place. I'd given up my old place. And that's when Ryan and I started dating. That's when I was staying in Carol's place. And Carol was in LA doing Wicked. And she had one of those old TVs in her bedroom. She had one of those old TVs that had a VCR in it, you know? And she had very few tapes, but one of the tapes she had was the PBS broadcast of Into the Woods. And Ryan and I would watch it in bed as we would drift off to sleep.
And look at the gorgeous connection of us both being naked in a bed with other gorgeous men while Bernadette goes, what song, what do you think is the horniest song in Into the Woods?
Well, it's Little right. Red, that it's hello, little girl. And then the other one that, this was just a moment in the woods.
Did you?
Our moment.
Sarah Bareilles in the revival, I was like, she does not. Oh. It's annoying how talented a pop girly like Sarah Bareilles then becomes a Broadway girly. I will listen to I don't know. Sometimes I'm like, I do become an old fag where I'm like,
the revivals are never as good as the originals.
But like the revival of Into the Woods was phenomenal. Yeah. I also need to circle back to Diane Keaton's furniture for a quick second. You've cuddled with Ryan and written in your journal and had daydreams on furniture that was sat upon by Diane Keaton.
Yeah. It was when she told me that, I was like, oh my God, I have to be so careful around this.
Well, it almost feels like the universe in a way had like bestowed upon you the honor of being given approval by character actresses. Carol Kane saying, yes, please enjoy my mint green furniture. Diane Keaton by proxy saying, please rest your weary feet as you're pounding the pavement in New York City. Yes. While you're, of course, filming this huge television show. I think that you've almost been like followed by these incredible energies, whether it was like, sure, you studying at Juilliard, but then to all cutting to now, where you get to be at the Emmy Awards celebrating this amazing show, Shrinking. And the fact that, I mean, if we can for a second talk about that moment where Jeff Hiller won and you, Bowen, and Coleman Domingo are standing up and you're beaming with pride. The fact that I, on a whim, put this photo together of the four of you and then it went crazy. You reposted it so sweetly, tagged That's a Gay Ass Podcast, which I am endlessly grateful to.
Oh my gosh.
I just want to ask, though, when
you're the reason that thing went viral. I mean, you're the reason that people were able to, because you put it together and people saw it. And it was a completely, obviously spontaneous moment. And in so many ways, better than any other outcome could have been. Like, even though I would have been so happy, I would have been so happy if Bowen had won or Coleman had won or Harrison had won or I had won. Or, I mean, really anybody. It was like, whatever. It's a great night. It's an honor to be nominated. But like that it was Jeff. Who is just so beloved?
Oh my God!
In real life and fiction life, and that we were able to. That was like, because you know, like that was the thing that I didn't know. Like I'd never been nominated for a thing that would be on TV, and when my name was called, you would see my reaction. And that was the only thing about the whole Emmy experience that I was nervous about. Was like, what is my face going to do?
Yeah.
When they don't call my name.
Yeah.
Like, I think I'll be able to stay happy. I'm not going to be like disappointed, but like because what are the, you know, I mean, it's such a miracle that I'm here anyway, but still like, what is your, because like you watch, that's what we all watch for.
Of course.
We want to see what
but
they.
But it's also, I think, a question of like, you're trying to control or plan a future that you've never experienced before. And it's the same thing, I think,
right.
Not to get totally. Too woo-woo in therapy about it, but I was crying in therapy all of 2 hours ago because I have this solo show that your dear friend Drew Drogi helped me coach me through, which, by the way, we shout out Drew. But I'm basically like, you know, ticket sales make me feel that I have to attribute my value to how the ticket sales are looking. And it's basically like, our value is not equated to the numbers or the successes. And I think that in a way, we try to control our feeling of value or our feeling of being respected or successful as humans, because especially when you're a young gay person, you don't feel understood or seen or valued. And so I think that there's a lot of sense of feeling of control. I want to control my face when they call up the name. I want to control how the tickets do, because then I can feel good. And I think that what was beautiful to watch is that you surrendered. You had no choice but to surrender to your actual feelings of when the name was called. And to see gays supporting gays, it was like, I think Jeff just was the perfect person to win, because he sort of embodies the feeling of artistry and kindness and hilariousness. And what was going through your mind when he won?
Well, another thing, one more word of hilariousness, kindness. What's the word? It's he's one of a kind. you know, like there's no one, not that there's not, I mean, obviously there's no one like me. There's no one like Bo, there's no one like Coleman, but there's really no one like Jeff. He's really one of a kind. And that he was the one that rose above was so validating for us, others who, you know, for me, who even though like, I mean, I'm one of a kind, I'm an original, but like, I'm also an assimilator, you know, like I've assimilated in a lot of ways. And I have, you know, like been the benefit of privilege in many, many ways. And there were four of us in the category. And when has that ever happened before? You know, like that I think was what was so,
yes,
like I was proud of that from the moment they announced it. I was like, oh my God, there's four of us.
Yeah, no, fuck yeah. That I think is the actual takeaway, which is that look how far representation has come. Look at how far. And also, like, we are allowed to be proud of ourselves as queer people and say, listen, while sure, the industry, the government, the rules of society have not always been like supporting gay people.
Yeah.
The fact that we can pursue this in spite of that and then actually get to really meaningful places in the industry because the industry, you know, it's the whole thing about like you have to be undeniable. And I think that you, Bowen, Coleman, Jeff, obviously Harrison Ford, are all undeniable talents. And I think that that's a bit of what my struggle is sort of taking the fact that I'm a hard worker. I put my whole pussy into everything I work on. And yet there's still these feelings of, but then why do I not feel good about myself? And so it's like, and like the listeners, these poor listeners hear me talk about it a lot because it's really something that comes to my mind. And so when I talk to someone like you, it really teaches me a lot because I not only realize that everybody has baggage and stuff that they're working through, but it also is that should not take away from our dreams coming true, us working really hard from our dreams. In fact, I wish I wrote this down, but you had a really, really great interview where you...
Hey, gay-ass girlies, I just read a romance horror book that I think you'd be absolutely obsessed with. Listen to this. It's called House of Rain by New York Times bestselling author Harley LaRue. And at first I was nervous it would be too scary, but y'all, it's scary and horny. And as a newly self-identified slut, I feel seen. Also, it takes place on a remote island in the Pacific Northwest, which I think the Pacific Northwest canonically has the hottest people. So if that doesn't make you squirt, babe, I don't know what will. Also, the book has so many gay-ass themes. I'm talking family drama, there's rumors, manipulation, and again, it's horny as hell. Now, the writing is also so good that it moves real fast and there's kink in it, and you will not be able to put this down. Harley LaRue is a queer writer who gets it. You can find House of Rain by Harley LaRue wherever books are sold, in print and in ebook. The gorgeous deluxe hardcover first printing is only available for a limited time, so grab yours before they are gone, babe.
Look, if you're still buying weed from some guy named Trevor in a parking lot, you're doing it wrong. Mood.com delivers legal THC products straight to your door. Gummies, vapes, flower, the good stuff. No sketchy DMs, no med card. Just add to cart. Check out, and boom, it's at your doorstep. It's legal in all 50 states, thanks to the Farm Bill, and Mood's products actually work. Seriously, this isn't gas station garbage. It's small batch, lab-tested, real results. Go to Mood.com, use code FIRST20 for 20% off, and never run dry again. That's Mood.com. Go get lit, legally.
We were asked to describe yourself, and something you said was like, lucky, curious, and I think relentless. And there was something of those types of words. And that really struck me because I was like, damn, to be able to acknowledge, sure, some privilege and luck in an industry that you need to have some luck to be able to land something like Ugly Betty or, you know, something like making your Broadway debut and then getting these amazing shows. But there's also a very relentless work ethic and insistence that you deserve to take up space and be there. And you, Michael Urie, have never stopped doing that. And I've looked up to that for your entire career.
Thank you. That's so nice. Thank you. That means a lot. And it is so much about, I mean, the luck is timing, you know, being in the right place at the right time and then being ready for that when you're in the right place at the right time, seizing it and not blowing it. Because that's another, that's, you know, it's like, you know, like you have to be good every time, especially when it's your time, especially when you have that opportunity. So, you know, I saw Ralph Macchio and Roger Bart and How to Succeed in Business when I was whatever, 16, 17. And then I had the chance, I was hosting a gala like I do. and it was for, I think it was for the Point Foundation. And they honored it was when the year Hairspray, the movie came out. And the guys who produced Hairspray, Craig Zaden and Neil Maron, were there, and we were chatting, and I think they had just or were about to, maybe that's all they had done. They hadn't started doing those musicals for TV, but I said to them that night, I was like, "How to Succeed in Business Without Really Trying. You should do it. You guys should do it, and you should cast me in it." And so then when they ended up being the people to produce the revival of this show on Broadway, I made a point to remind them that it was my idea. Not that it was there. I didn't know that they would do it on stage. So I thought they might do it as a movie.
Yeah.
And it was like the height of Ugly Betty's popularity. And I was like, I could get in this. I could be in this, you know, like right now this I'm, you know, like this side's role in this kind of a musical with what I'm doing here. This like kind of makes sense. That's another thing. It's like, I was realistic about what I could get away with and what I was, you know, like that. I wasn't like, I want to play Billy Bigelow in Carousel. I was I want to play the Charles Nelson Reilly role in that musical.
So there's an awareness that comes into knowing sort of not only what you want to do, but also what makes the most sense that sets yourself up for success in order to like receive the luck and then to be prepared for when the luck strikes. I think that sometimes we are told to not take up so much space, because then if you take up too much space, then you're like either annoying or huge ego or think you're more than you are. But you seem to like find that balance of like, no, you can still be like a kind person who works hard and also wants to take up space, but not like turn people off or away. I think that's like a really beautiful balance that you have. But if we are going into some of the roles and the people you've worked with, I think that How to Succeed is an amazing one. I think that you talked about in interviews, one of your idols is Kevin Kline. So because Kevin Kline has also worked with some huge divas, much like you having moments with Vanessa Williams, Jinx Monsoon, the famous female diva Harrison Ford, any divas next on your dream list of like incredible performers or women that you would like to be on set or stage with?
Well, I do have this. So I have had some pretty incredible stage and screen mothers, starting with Patti LuPone, who played my mother on Ugly Betty.
Yes.
And then Mercedes Rule was my mother in Torch Song. Jane Alexander was my mother in a Broadway show called Grand Horizons. Kathy Najimy was my mother in the Christmas movie Single All the Way. So I have this, I want to rack up the mothers and someday write a book about it. That's
genius, Michael.
That's my kind of like secret goal. Now it's not a secret. I just said it on your podcast, I've got my eye on a bunch of moms. People like, you should play my mom.
And we need Andrea Martin on that list.
Oh yes, of course. Andrea Martin. I would love Andrea Martin. Judith Light. I've tried, really campaigned to get, I've worked with Judith on Ugly Betty, but I've really tried to get her to be my mom on things. So I've got my eye on there's a couple of, and I also think like, I love working with these women because they're all so hungry to be, to act like, you know, like they want to work. They want to get in there and work, and they're not, especially like the older they get, the more they're like, I'm not done. You know, that sense of, because if we do that, I mean, not us gays, we celebrate these women so much, but like society and the industry kind of pushes them away. And I think that they're, they're the best.
I mean, it's like Bette Midler was just on Watch What Happens Live, and I don't think it's rude to talk about age. I think it's a celebration when we talk about age. Bette Midler is turning in a little more than a month, 80 years old. And I think that it's a beautiful gift to see our beloved mothers and character actresses continue to work and express themselves, because I think the frame of thinking is that people are like, okay, when you become older, especially if you're a woman, they're like, well, then you're either less valuable or no one cares about what you think. And for us gays, we know it's the opposite. We know that it's like they've learned so much more. They've got so much.
And I love that they do all these like these four pack movies where they put like four of them in a movie together. Like Book Club or like 80 for Brady or all these like movies. I love that. But I also think like they're so much better than these movies. They I'm glad that they exist. I'm glad they're getting paid and I'm glad that they're getting out there. But like they should be doing, you know, they should be doing like they should be the longest journey in tonight. You know, they should be doing like the real meat.
Hard agree. Because I feel like June Squibb right now is having those types of roles where it's like
Broadway debut. She's about to be in Marjorie Prime on Broadway at 96 years old.
Oh, I forgot.
Maybe not her debut, but
whatever. We'll make that the narrative. I mean, yeah, it's such a gift that I think gays have, which is taste, and that we get to really enjoy the like best of the industry in the world. The fact that we can sit here and be like, oh my God, you subletted an apartment from Carol Kane. Like that is, no. You know, there's like one straight man listening to this right now who's like Googling like, oh, right, from, and then he's going to name like Kimmy Schmidt.
To your point about celebrating them getting older and how amazing it is that Bette Midler's about to be 80 and she's still like a complete spitfire. That, I think what you're saying there is why we were all so devastated about Diane Keaton.
Yes, yes.
Like it was really, and I've always loved her, but I wouldn't even, I mean, you know, I wouldn't have said until that happened that she was, that she was like really, really in my heart, meaningful to me. But when she died, I was devastated. And like, and I, every time I would see anything on my feed about her, I would stop and look at it and watch any, you know, talk show appearance or any clip that somebody posted.
Well, to your point about Jeff Hiller, I think that she also was incredibly unique and incredibly herself. I mean, think about her fashion, think about her, the roles. Obviously, when we get to the end of the interview in a few minutes, I'll ask you about the character actress you would save. But I think what we say about the character actresses is that they are simultaneously people that we love their performances and we also love how they are off screen, or like we picture ourselves smoking a joint or drinking a glass of wine. Or just kikiing with them. And Diane Keaton, I mean, imagine her laughing and putting her head back with a bowler hat. It falls off. Oh my God, can you? Like, I'm just like, my fantasies about Diane Keaton, because really, talking about powerful women and putting them together the right way is the First Wives Club. The First Wives Club was an early example of a movie that made me gay. I say Sister Act 2 was one of the first, but seeing Bette Midler, Goldie Hawn, Diane Keaton, and then the appearance of Stalker Channing, and then we get just like, and then the lesbian storyline, all of it. It's just like
Maggie Smith and Sarah Jessica Parker.
Sarah Jessica. Oh my God,
Bronson Pinchot. I mean, it's just
an embarrassment of riches. But it would not be a gay ass podcast if I did not make sure to go into some more Michael Urie lore before we get to the final chapter of this. One of the Michael Urie lores is you had a self tape that the Hollywood Reporter actually posted for your Shrinking audition, which I thought was really, really cool to see the BTS. Yeah. And you said in this interview that your agent called you after you didn't hear for a while and basically gave you a bit of a bait and switch where they said explain what exactly happened and how you found it out.
So the agents love to do that. This has happened to me a couple times over the years where they give you a little bait and switch. So I've gotten very good about making an audition, sending it, and forgetting about it. Took me a long time, but I got to a point where I can actually do that. I can send it away and not think about it.
Yeah.
And so I had made this tape. It was I was happy with what I did. Very cool project. Jason Segel, Bill Lawrence, Brett Goldstein. Didn't know Harrison was part of it yet, but you know, it's like, this is a cool thing. Apple TV. it's a series. It's not a pilot. It's a series. So definitely not going to think about that because it's too good to be true. And then weeks went by, a month. And my agent said, there's an update about shrinking. And I was like, oh, cool. And I assumed it meant you got to make another tape or you're going to get on Zoom with the creators or they're going to fly you out and do a screen test with Jason Segel. And we get on the conference call with everybody, my whole team, quote unquote team. And I only get on the phone with my team if it's good news or bad news. They never get on the phone with me unless it's like good news or bad news. And so I'm like, this is going to be good news. This is going to be a screen test. And I was in tech for something else. I was doing some play and I was like, oh, I hope it doesn't mess up the play. That was what I was thinking. And I get on and my agent's like, he's like, well, we really thought this was going to go to a test deal. And I was like, oh, bummer. So it didn't? And he goes, no, you got it. And I just got the job, which is like, you know, it was like cute. You got me. but I had no idea that was even possible, that I could like just get the job. I never met anybody. I had never met a single person involved.
Well, they saw, I think it's, you know, it's a testament to just like you put your pussy into the tape and they also like know. I mean, isn't a lot of the businesses like they just want to know that you're also good to work with and like can also deliver. And did you, when you found out,
checked in with people, you know, like, and I think they were, you know, I mean, I know, you know, Jason Segel is the most prepared actor I've ever worked with on like an on-camera job. I've never seen him even looking at a script. He's so incredibly prepared. And I was really prepared in that audition. And I think that, you know, I think that goes a long way when I didn't really think about it until I saw it back after they posted it on the Hollywood Reporter. And I was like, oh yeah, look at that. That's like, I was like, and of course I watched it and I was like, ugh, I hate this. But I also, because I know, you know, I was like, oh, my hair looks stupid. And why did I do that? And why did I get a choice? And I wish it was this other scene or, you know, like whatever. But I was like, but I'm prepared. That's
not only were you prepared and the performance, I watched all the tapes on the Hollywood Reporter article. And I really, 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 really loved the performance. But if I may have a scotch of horniness, there's a peak of your armpit hair, which is really lovely. And I want to make sure you know that.
Really? What am I even wearing? Oh, because I had
a t-shirt. You have like a short t-shirt for like
the pickleball scene.
The pickleball scene, yeah.
Right. Oh, okay. I'm here.
Just making sure you know there is an appreciative audience. You have also said for these self-tapes that's one of the only, like, the biggest fights you have with Ryan are during your self-tapes.
Yes.
Do you have any tips for us comedic actors who want to stay married?
Use a friend. It is wild because we do fight about that. And I'm lucky that I've been around long enough and I've done enough stuff that when I get like, when something comes my way, an audition wise, you know, like I'm like in the mix, you know what I mean?
Yeah,
like
they're
like, it's not like, sure, let's see what he can do. Like, you know, like they saw me on something and then so it's a little bit more serious, maybe. Yeah. I mean, is that the right word? Or I don't know. Maybe it's a little bit, I guess I'm being taken a little more seriously. So the stakes aren't quite as high, or I'm not sure, but, and I'm lucky that way. And so, and because of that, I have less auditions than like a working act, so Ryan auditions for things more than I do, is the short answer, but he doesn't use me anymore. He doesn't use me anymore. Unless they were in a pinch. And it's been long enough now that like we can, but if I'm even like a little bit, if I even like, you want to try it? Like, then it's like, I'm dead. He's done. We're breaking up. He's going to shoot it again with somebody else. You know, it's like, it just doesn't.
You're not alone. You're not alone. We are the exact same way. I mean, yeah, we're the exact. It's like some couples, like, you know, we're not all Chip and Joanna Gaines. We're not all building empires together and working at the silos, you know, like emotionally. Yeah. I can't do that with my husband. And I love
him. Is he also an actor? Is he?
He's not. But when we first met, we met at an audition for Fiddler on the Roof. And we were both doing musical theater. This was 12 years ago. Luckily, he has a gorgeous job in marketing, and he gets us health insurance, and he still loves theater. He also loved Once Upon a Mattress with you, Michael Urie. He gets it, but he's no longer pursuing it, which thank God for us. Thank God.
Ryan and I work really well together. He's in Richard II as well. We actually work really well together. I love being around him. It's specifically the stress of making an audition and that it's, there's something about that that just like we can't, although he was my reader on the shrinking audition, and we did not fight on that. I think there was something about that that we were like, okay, this job is this is what I call an A+ job. Like there's no downside to a job like this. So let's just both agree that this is best for our family, that we make this work and we try to get me this job. And then we can buy a house, you know, like it's like, you know, like that kind of a thing. But
have you bought the house yet?
We did. We have a cute little house.
Mazel tov. That's the goddamn dream. Yeah. And I am just like, yeah, watch, being able to talk to you about this is just letting, the universe is now telling me it happens and it can happen, and we just have to continue to put one foot in front of the other, and you, Michael Urie, continue to do so, which is why I'm going to put my next foot forward into the final question of this gay-ass podcast, which is, if the world was ending, you could only save one character actress, who would you save?
Judith Ivy. Not Judith Light. Not she Dana
thought,
Ivy.
I thought she was going to say Light. She went to Judith Ivy.
Ivy, honey.
Oh, my God.
But I will say, the thing about character actresses, and this is no criticism of this perfect question, but most of them can save themselves. Most of them,
I agree.
Don't need saving. And I don't think Judith Ivy really needs saving.
Wait, can you please cancel me on this podcast and say, how dare you, gay white man, think you need to save women?
How dare you think Margot Martindale needs saving?
Now, I'm going to rephrase the question now. If you could help these poor, frail women. No, I think that's a great way to sort of actually build up the women that we answer is by saying that while, of course, there is no need.
Right.
But who do we think deserves who we bow down to?
Yes.
And Judith Ivy is a gorgeous answer.
Judith Ivy is one of the best. I mean, they're all amazing, of course. But she has, I saw her in this play on Broadway called Voices in the Dark. This was a scary play on Broadway in like 1999 when I first moved to New York. And she had this, line. She was so good. It was a scary play, but she was hilarious. She could get a laugh on anything. And she was the star. It was like Judith Ivy in. And she had, there was this guy, this character that came on stage. She was in the cabin and she needed somebody to come fix a hot tub or something like that. And this guy came on stage to like help her fix it. And he was like awkward and schlubby. And she realized through the course of the scene that he was into her. He was attracted to her. And she had this line that was, she said, You want to do me a favor was the line. And she delivered it. Like in the moment that she realized he was into her, she goes, "You want to do me a favor?" And she put this little pause there. And I was like, I see what you did, Judith Ivy. There was no pause there. You added that and you made that line two lines.
You want to do me a favor?
Yeah, it was exactly God. That. And it was so adorable, so funny. And in the midst of this, like, thriller play, which are so rare, you know, there's so few of them. And I don't think it was a hit. I don't think it was like, it was what I also remember second acting it. because I would second act shows back then. I went back and second acted it. And she was out that night, which was weird. And I went, like, sat in the balcony and it was, like, empty. And I was like, oh, I wonder if this show's in trouble. And she was the star. It was like a Judith Ivy vehicle. And it was about, she played a radio DJ. And in the play, they had audio recordings of her on the radio. And when the understudy was on, it was still Judith Ivy.
Come on, camp. It's giving. It's giving. We didn't have time to record
they
the
really didn't think Judith was gonna miss.
I think that what you're pointing out that that's really beautiful is seeing a character actress like someone like Judith Ivy do a play in person. There's nothing like it. I think obviously we love the movies and we want them to make their money, but like when I saw Laurie Metcalf on Broadway, when I saw, there was a play, one of my favorite memories. And then one of my favorite memories is there's an actress named Lisa Emery, and she
I love her.
She did off-Broadway The Atlantic when I was in college. I was studying there, and she did a night of two plays. It was The Collection and A Kind of Alaska. And she played a woman who had been in a coma for like decades. And when she woke up as an older woman, she was realizing everything she had missed in her life. She was meeting her brothers who were older now. She realized her parents had passed away. And she was like this lived in actress, but playing an 11-year-old girl. And I thought about my life after that play ended. I sat in those, I couldn't leave the theater because I was weeping. And I'm like 19 and a half. And she gave a performance that made me feel so lucky to have witnessed it. And made me also feel like, oh my God, theater is so impermanent. And how am I one of the lucky people that gets to see this? Seeing an actress just put her all into something and give such humanity. Mm. Oh my God. I cannot say enough about Lisa Emery, about Michael Urie.
Ryan did a play with Lisa Emery. I'm going to tell him to tell her that you said that, because she is amazing.
Oh, and
that
my is God.
A beautiful memory and such a wonderful, specific thing that, yes, only theater. I remember when we were doing Torch Song and Mercedes Rule played my mother, she would come on, you know, late in the play, after the intermission, late in the play.
Yeah.
And the audience, and she was kind of the villain of the play. I mean, she's kind of the villain, but like the most wonder, she's like the audience loved her so much. The second she stepped on stage. And I always felt like this is such a privilege to be on stage with her and act with her, but also like get to watch. I'm getting like emotional just thinking about it, getting to watch her get another bite at the apple, you know, like getting to have another, because I saw her in The Goat. Of course, she won a Tony for Lost in Yonkers. But like to know, like you're getting another tour de force, another opportunity to have like a tour de force. And I get to be here to like help you, like, you know.
And you get to be literally on that side of the lights experiencing it with her. Oh my God. It's such an amazing memory. And I'm so happy to celebrate you on this gay ass podcast. Michael Urie,
I hope
everybody listening gets to see you if they're in New York City in Richard II, running October 28th to November 30th, featuring not only Michael's gorgeous partner, Ryan. Tell him I said that as well, but also Lux Pascal, incredible,
yes,
an amazing cast. But besides that, can you please tell these listeners where to follow you and anything else you would like for them to know?
Oh gosh, well, I'm Michael Urie Likes It on Instagram. Check me out there. That's from the old Mikey Likes It commercials. That's how I got that name, from Life Cereal. I'm not really on Twitter anymore. Or whatever it's called. But yeah, find me on there. The new season of Shrinking is coming out soon. It's going to be really good. And maybe I'll go back into O'Mary at some point. They like to have people back. I would love to go back. It was such a dream. But I'll be around. You know, you can't get rid of me.
Well, and thank goodness gracious, everyone. It's Michael's stuff is linked in the description. Go watch Shrinking. Go see Richard II. And we are just very grateful to you and your gay assery. And one day I'll get to tell you. We'll talk more theater stories in person one day.
I would love to. God willing. I would love it. Thank you so much. It's such a pleasure, Eric. Thank you.
I'm telling you, Michael Urie is that girl. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a comment on YouTube, or if you've not yet left a 5-star review on your podcast listener platform of choice, please do so. It would mean the world to get those numbers up, because I just don't ask enough. And maybe today it can be your day to leave that 5-star review. I will also tell you the bonus episode this week is getting a lot of clicks online. It's with Emmy LaRoe. He's a 6'5" bisexual musician in New York City and really does love the pull and the puss. I'm so sorry. But that is at substack.com/@EricWills. And you can also watch the first half of the episode on YouTube or listen on your podcast platform of choice. I love you so much. I will see you at my show tomorrow in LA. And I'll see you next week for another gay ass ep. Stay gay. You've been listening to That's a Gay Ass Podcast, hosted by me, Eric Williams. If you want to see and hear more, make sure you subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, and follow the Instagram at Gay Ass Podcast. For more gay assery, the real girlies are over on Substack, where you get bonus episodes every single week and live chats with me and other gay ass guests. That's a Gay Ass Podcast is executive produced by Eric Williams and produced by Nathaniel McClure. We'll see you next week.